I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories in the outdoors. Support for this episode comes from Fjällräven, serving nature for over 50 years, and from Kind, makers of healthy and delicious snacks. If you'd like to try some Kind snacks, there's a special offer for Out There listeners. You can get a sample box with 10 different bars for just $10 with free shipping. That's a $20 value. For details, go to kindsnacks.com/out. Have you ever had a question that you had to find the answer to? The kind of question that left you so curious you lost sleep over it? Like where you stay up late into the night scouring the internet for information? Today's episode is about that kind of curiosity, obsessive and all-consuming curiosity. It's also about a man who tried to become a wild animal. The man's name is Charles Foster, and his story gives us an inside look at what happens when the traditional methods of understanding the world fall short. Caitlin Chevalier brings us the story.
I first saw Charles Foster in a photograph. He was dressed from neck to ankle in corduroy, looking very much the part of a university professor. But something in the photograph was out of place. He was curled up on the forest floor, lying there, eyes closed, with his head propped up in a pile of green moss. Sensing there was a good story behind all this, I started investigating. Who was this Charles Foster? And why was he dressed like he was going to dinner, but lying on the ground? A quick search led me to more hard-to-explain images. Charles on his hands and knees, crouching behind a tree, and Charles wading, up to his neck, in a forest stream. Finally, a caption started to explain things. Charles was in the woods of Devon, England, where he was trying to understand animals in a way that few people have ever experienced animals before. He was trying to get inside an animal's head by becoming a wild animal himself. As it turned out, the story behind these images started decades earlier, when Charles was just a boy growing up in Yorkshire.
In our little privet-hedged garden, there was a blackbird, and it looked at me, and I realised that it knew something about our little garden that I didn't know, and I wanted to know what that was.
Charles wasn't like most kids, who would see a blackbird, maybe watch it for a few seconds, and then quickly go back to playing with friends. Instead, he was intensely curious about this bird. He was curious in a way that overwhelmed him. What drove this curiosity was that young Charles was convinced that the blackbirds knew something about the world that he didn't know. Naturally, Charles had to figure out what that something was. To find the answer to the bird's secret knowledge, he had to know what was going on inside the bird's mind. So Charles set about researching the bird in his own, you could say, alternative way. First, he collected egg fragments from the blackbirds.
I mapped the garden. I traced the flight path of the blackbirds. I went round checking the nests of the blackbirds every day. So I pickled the blackbird brain in formalin and went to sleep at night as a kid holding it, wondering if something of what that blackbird knew would seep into me as I slept.
And he didn't stop there. Charles also collected blackbird tongues, which he pulled from the mouths of roadkill and kept inside the tiny drawers of matchboxes.
So I stuffed a dead blackbird that I'd found by the side of the road, and it circled on a thread above my head as I went to sleep. And of course, those things taught me very little about what it was to be a blackbird and what that blackbird knew about the garden that I didn't know.
We've probably all tried things as kids, which we look back on now as adults and realize we're a little far-fetched. Like trying to dig a hole to China, or wearing pajamas inside out hoping for a snow day. And like that, Charles was learning that just holding an animal's brain doesn't unlock its secrets. But he still couldn't put the blackbird mystery to rest. Looking into their eyes was like catching a glimpse of a pirate's crumpled treasure map, where he couldn't for the life of him make out where the cross was. And decades later, that childhood curiosity still hadn't faded. Charles wanted to get inside the heads of animals, to learn about their thoughts firsthand. He wanted the pure animal experience, not a human description of what an animal experience might be like. It's kind of like learning a new language. You have to first translate in your head before speaking. But Charles didn't want a translation. He wanted fluency. He wanted to speak the animal language without having to first filter it through human explanations. He felt this visceral need to get as close as possible to the source, to explore how animal bodies worked and what thoughts occupied their minds. Charles moved on from his boyhood backyard experiments to more sophisticated methods of research. He studied veterinary medicine, where he spent years examining the physiology of the animal body. He thought this might unlock the mysteries of the animal brain, in the same way that taking apart a car engine might explain where its power comes from.
My training as a veterinarian gave me an insight into the way that sensory receptors work and how some of the information which is received by those sensory receptors is processed centrally.
He learned how the animal eye processes light and uses that light to construct images. He memorized all the names of the nerve endings responsible for telling animals where their bodies are in space. But understanding animal vision or hearing or taste doesn't explain something as abstract as animal consciousness. Knowing how a rabbit's eye takes in light and how its brain processes the image of a carrot doesn't reveal what that animal dreams about, or if it dreams at all. This barrier to understanding deeply frustrated Charles. He had gone to vet school hoping to get further inside the mind of the blackbird, but instead, he came away feeling further from understanding than ever before. It seemed science didn't have all the answers.
I was schooled as a scientist, and I think that school was a disastrous one for anyone attempting a project like the one that I did. It forced me to approach these animals in a drearily mechanistic way, which made them more difficult to understand.
If vet school wasn't giving him answers, maybe something a little less removed from the animal world would. Maybe if he went out into the animals' habitats, that would help. And so he took up nature writing. But it turns out that also had its limitations.
Traditional nature writing is done by people who stride colonially 6 feet above the ground which they purport to describe. And normally, when I go into a wood, I don't see or perceive that wood at all. I can't hear the birdsong because of all the cognitive tinnitus which is going on. What I'm describing usually when I do my traditional nature writing is not what that wood is like, but what Charles Foster's thoughts about that wood are like, which are very far removed from what the wood is really like and hugely less interesting.
The problem with traditional nature writing, Charles thought, was that it examines the natural world through the biased lens of the human experience. Much like adults are too biased by their adult lives to remember what it's like to be a child, humans are too distracted by their humanness to see the world apart from how it serves them. At this point, Charles had exhausted the conventional options for understanding the animal mind. He tried everything. He dissected their bodies, observed them in the wild, and read countless books about the environments they lived in. But still, he wasn't inside their heads. Charles had a question science alone couldn't answer. So he started dreaming up a new approach, a pretty radical one. He decided to become a wild animal by dropping down on his hands and knees and rewinding the evolutionary clock, by living in animals' homes and surviving on their diets. Charles had to decide how to begin his transformation. While his studies and research could inform his approach, there wasn't exactly a step-by-step guide for how to proceed. So Charles started with his own version of step one, deciding which animal to focus on. He looked at a few different species, red deer, otters, swifts, and badgers.
I chose these particular species for a number of reasons. Firstly, because they were, at least to begin with, animals that I quite liked. They had to be animals that it wasn't completely ridiculous to think that I might relate to in some way. So I have had difficulty enough persuading people of my thesis in relation to these fairly human-like animals. If I tried to do it in the relation to a mosquito, just think of the barrage of abuse that I would have had.
Over the years, Charles would end up trying to become many different kinds of animals. But the one he spent the most time on was the badger. He pursued the badger lifestyle through different seasons, even spending time living underground, as badgers do. After choosing a few animal species to focus on, Charles approached step two of his human to wild animal transformation. For Charles, the next step was to train. Specifically, he had to train his sense of smell. For most of us humans, eyesight is our dominant sense, but badgers mainly use their noses. So Charles set about training his nose.
How did I train my own senses? Various silly party games. One way of doing it is to blindfold yourself and try and follow the scent trails which are made by different types of joss sticks in each part of the house.
For example, Charles put different types of cheese in each corner of a room and then spun himself around until he was disoriented. After some practice, he was able to reorient himself just by referencing the different smells of cheese coming from each corner of the room.
Most of it is simply about paying attention in a way that we don't normally do to things other than our vision.
Charles joined a blind tasting wine club. He clipped different leaves from plants outside and placed them by his pillow, studying the subtle and not so subtle differences between their scents. He smelled standing up and he smelled lying down, noting how environmental aromas change at different elevations. Eventually, Charles's training paid off, and he graduated from smelling cheese and wine and plant clippings to being able to describe an environment entirely by smell, just as descriptively as someone might visually describe a landscape.
We learnt how the scent oozes out of the ground when the sun comes up and then surges up the side of the valley during the day as it gets hotter and then ebbs back down the valley, how it ricochets between trees and off rocks.
Now that he was trained in the ways of smelling the world, Charles set out one June day for the Black Mountains of Wales to begin living as a badger. He picked a scenic spot. The Black Mountains are rumored to have inspired Tolkien when he sat down to write The Hobbit. It's a place that inspires myth and folklore, and where hilltops are covered in every shade of green. So geared up with little more than a headlamp, Charles dropped down on his hands and knees and quickly got down to the first order of business, finding food. Charles's close friend Bert lived just outside the woods and brought him a fish pie, which Charles accepted. It sounds like cheating, but Charles was quick to defend himself. Badgers, he says, are opportunistic omnivores. They eat nearly anything, and no badger would turn its nose up at a fish pie, so neither did he. But of course, he didn't get fish pies every day. So after that first feast, he was left to scrounge at more authentic badger food. The majority of a badger's diet is earthworms. Charles never replaced an entire meal with earthworms, but he ate more than a few. Enough to know the difference between a musty-tasting worm from northern France and the earthworms from southwest England, which Charles says taste like leather and stout. Others, he says, tasted like lemongrass, decay, paraffin, and burning rubber. But the dominant flavor in all of them was the same, and kind of what you'd expect, a combination of slime and the earth. In case the taste wasn't bad enough, when you put the worm in your mouth, it senses it's in trouble and tries to escape through the gaps in your teeth.
Thank you.
Support for Out There comes from Kind. And just to be clear, Kind bars taste nothing like earthworms. Not that I've tried earthworms, but Kind bars are actually very yummy. If you haven't tried them, Kind snacks are meant to be tasty and healthy, and they're meant with ingredients you can pronounce, things like nuts and whole grains. The idea is that you should not have to choose between health and taste. You should be able to treat yourself and not feel guilty. And I've got to say, a lot of their products really are a treat. I'm particularly fond of the dark chocolate nuts and sea salt bar, as well as some of the healthy grains bars. If you'd like to give Kind Snacks a try, we've got a special deal for you. For $10, you can get a box with 10 different snacks, and that includes free shipping. This would normally cost $20, but again, Out There listeners can get it for $10. When you order the box, you'll also automatically be enrolled in the Kind Snack Club, which is set up to send you monthly shipments of your favorite bars at a discount. To get in on the deal, just go to kindsnacks.com/out. That's kindsnacks.com/out. And now, back to the story.
During the rest of that first day out in the woods, Charles built himself a badger home. He dug a deep trench and covered it with branches and bracken. He drank water from the nearby river, careful to avoid the leeches that were just below the surface. And then he hung out, like a badger would hang out. Of course, his body wasn't quite like a badger's body. Imitating what a badger would do didn't always come naturally. For example, Charles's badger home was really dusty, and while a badger wouldn't be bothered, the dust threw Charles into sneezing fits. But soon the dust settled, and Charles curled up on his bed, made of fern branches, and went to sleep. He dreamt the kind of dreams people dream in the tropics, those intense dreams that sit just below consciousness. But in his dreams, he wasn't a badger.
I was dreaming my human dreams for most of the time. It would be arrogant, presumptuous to say that I managed to become a badger in my unconscious. I didn't dream like a badger dreams, if a badger dreams.
Charles remained in the woods for weeks after his first day of ditch digging and fish pie. He went through the daily rituals that consume a lot of a badger's time, eating, sleeping, and smelling, and he got pretty good at it. It only took him 4 days to become nocturnal, and he even scraped a dead squirrel off the road for dinner without much complaining. By many measures, Charles was succeeding at becoming a badger, but he still felt like his project was failing. He wasn't exactly getting inside the head of the badger like he wanted to. The thoughts inside Charles's head were the thoughts of an outsider. He marveled at the newness of what he was experiencing, the lack of buildings, the moss, the smells. He missed home and his family. And he never experienced the one emotion that defines prey animal species. He didn't experience fear.
By and large, humans are not frightened of animals these days. Yes, it is true that at some level of my subconscious, I realize that there are things out there that are going to get me. But that's not a dominant feature in my relationship with the world. By and large, I approach the world as a creature at the top of an evolutionary pyramid, at the top of the food chain. And so I wasn't able to recreate the experience of being afraid in anything like the way that the prey species that I looked at here.
It seemed Charles was going through the motions of being a badger without transforming mentally into a badger. It's fair to say a badger wouldn't compare the taste of an earthworm to stout or paraffin wax, but Charles and the badger were at least eating the same thing, sleeping in the same kinds of places, and spending their time the same way during the day. But with emotion, Charles was forced to face his humanness. You can't fake fear, and no matter how much he prepared or how earnest his attempts, he didn't experience storybook transformation. He was still a human trying to be a badger, and he was disappointed by that. It's a disappointment that would bleed into the book he later wrote about the experience.
I had hoped that it would be a description of what's inside the brain of a badger rather than what is inside the brain of Charles Foster. And I wasn't able to draw a distinction between the contents of those two brains as neatly as I'd hoped.
After weeks of living in the mountains as a badger, Charles stood upright and walked out, just like that. Summer came to a close, and so did his life as a badger. He returned to civilization and his human responsibilities. He was, after all, a barrister, a professor, and a father to 6 children. But what waited for him on the other side wasn't life as usual. Instead, it was a strange kind of culture shock.
I went back to the little, pretty, gentle town of Abergavenny in Wales, and it seemed thunderous, towering, oppressive, frightening. When people spoke to me in a kind, gentle way, it seemed to me that they were bellowing at me, and I resented it very much. When I got on the train was like a sitting inside a thunderstorm. I put on my iPod and a recording of birdsong, because that seemed to me to be the only healthy noise that I could beam into myself. I felt that I needed that.
Back in the city, Charles's adventure in the wild started getting attention. He described what he'd done in a book called Being a Beast, Adventures Across the Species Divide. After it was published, his story was sensationalized. Some even thought he was crazy. People were distracted by the strangeness of his project. To some, Charles's story was a piece of tabloid journalism, more than a story about humanity's connection to nature.
The world's full of weird people, I don't like to say.
Dr. Charles Foster must really, really love animals. He has eaten worms so he could live with them.
I know.
I was looking at that part. Great. I said, I would have brought something.
I don't know if I'd trust him if he was my defense attorney.
So I do find myself trying to defend myself against the charge of being simply insane. And I have to say that I regard the fact that I have to make those attempts as an indication that this book has failed as a project. Because what I had hoped to do in this book was to indicate that attempts to get inside the head of non-human animals are part of the oldest and most fundamental attempts at human self-definition that there have been. In all hunter-gatherer cultures, in all cultures that are less disastrously divorced from the natural world than ours are, they would be regarded, that what I have done here wouldn't be regarded as anything remotely exceptional. So I wanted people at the end of this book to shrug and say, Yes, having explained it in the way that you have explained it, we can see that this was really a very trite, dull exercise, which all of us have been doing at some level.
But that wasn't what happened. No amount of sincerity could get most people to see Charles's project as anything other than the adventures of a madman. To make matters worse, he failed to achieve the very thing he set out to do. He didn't get inside the head of the badger. As much as he criticized traditional nature writers, Charles followed in their path. He also can only describe the animal experience through the biased lens of his own human experience. But does that mean the whole project was a waste of time? Charles says it's not that simple. He's convinced that better understanding is still possible. Scientific discoveries never happen in a day, and are rarely the result of one person. Figuring out how things work is a slow process, and often the result of many people's successes and failures. Charles didn't transform into a badger. He didn't get into the animals' minds. But he did get a little closer to understanding them. So maybe his failure to answer the questions he set out with isn't really a failure. Maybe it's just the next step in a quest for understanding that will span centuries. A quest that subsequent generations will continue in ways we can't even imagine. After all, some of society's biggest advances in medicine, in physics and chemistry, started with projects that seemed a little crazy at the time.
That was Caitlin Chevalier. She's a Brooklyn-based researcher and artist with a background in physics and design, and her work often looks at themes of natural science and disaster. She's worked as a contributing producer at the Leonard Lopage Show on WNYC, and you can find her work in Wired, Fast Company, The Creators Project, and on her website, CaitlinChevalier.com. We've got a link on our site as well, in case you're not instantly clear on how to spell Chevalier. Also, if you'd like to check out Charles Foster's book, it's called Being a Beast. And finally, this piece included music by Aaron Leader. Before we wrap up, I have a special announcement to make. I'll be participating in a live storytelling event in Fort Collins, Colorado on September 20th. The event is called The Great Outdoors, and it's being hosted by KUNC, which is the local NPR station. Several people, including myself, will be telling stories about life-changing moments on the trail, in the mountains, in the woods, etc. Plus, there will be a chance for an audience member to tell a story. If you want to get in on that, you can drop your name in the hat before the show, and we'll draw one storyteller. The event is September 20th at Wolverine Farm Public House in Fort Collins. It starts at 6 p.m. and it's free. For more information, head over to KUNC's Facebook page. And if you're in the area, please do come on by. Alex and I will both be there. We'll have some out there swag for sale, and we would love to meet you in person. Support for Out There comes from Fjällräven, making the outdoors accessible for everyone. Fjällräven makes durable, environmentally friendly gear for outdoor enthusiasts. Their products are designed in Sweden and worn throughout the world. I recently spoke with Fjällräven's North American CEO, Nathan Dopp. He says, in addition to making wonderful products, Fjällräven approaches business with a Scandinavian mindset.
They force us to appreciate work-life balance and appreciate making time for being outside. We had an issue a couple weeks ago where we all had to record how many days we'd spend in tents this year because it was an initiative and there was a, not a contest, but like a company challenge to see, you know, how many days we, as a company we could spend outside.
Okay, so how many nights have you spent in a tent this year?
I shouldn't have brought that up. I only have five. So that's, I am on the lean end of the company chart.
Fjällräven's products range from clothing to backpacks to tents and sleeping bags. You might have seen their popular Kanken backpacks around. Anyway, all their gear is designed to let you enjoy nature without worrying about your equipment or about its impact on the environment. For more information, visit fjällräven.us. And if you're not sure how to spell Fjällräven, just head over to our website, outthereshow.com. We've got a link to them. A big thanks to Thomas Flensted, Lynn Szabo, Clifford Gursky, Jonathan Cohen, Thomas Rensselaer, and Deb and Vince Garcia for their financial contributions to Out There. If you haven't yet had a chance to contribute to our Patreon campaign, you can do so at patreon.com/outtherepodcast. We've got a link to that on our website as well. And the money we're raising through this campaign is to enable us to produce Out There more frequently. That's it for this episode. Our theme music was written by Jared Arnold, and our marketing and business development director is Alex Egerking. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.